I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Jewish historian and director of the UC Davis Humanities Institute, David Beal, whose new book is Hasidism, A New History.
Good afternoon. I am Stephanie Singer. I'm the Director of Arts and Ideas here at the JCC. And on behalf of all of us, we're really delighted to welcome you to today's program, Hasidism, A New History, with Professor David Beal. I am delighted to introduce to the lectern our friend, Rabbi Peretz Wolf-Prusan, who's the Chief Program Officer / Senior Educator at Lehrhaus Judaica, who will do the honors of introducing David and getting the program off the ground.
Peretz.
It's my pleasure to introduce David Beal, the Emanuel Ringelblum Distinguished Professor of Jewish History at UC Davis. David is the only person that I know of who has won the National Book Award 3 times. David has been a friend of Lehrhaus since he and our founding director, Fred Rosenbaum, first met when they were in graduate school at Berkeley 45 years ago. And their first publications were appropriately in the student journal Jewish Radical. His most recent publication is the first comprehensive history of Hasidism, Hasidism, A New History. That's the part that caught my eye. It's a new history. We'll hear more about that, a new approach to that new history. A monumental project, just by tonnage and comprehensiveness. He headed an international team of scholars, all listed here. His next publication is a biography of Gershom Scholem. I did consult my colleague, Fred Rosenbaum, now retired in the Holy Land of Brooklyn. Any remarks he would have made had he been here at this moment? And he said, despite everything that he has done scholastically, academically, winning awards for teaching, he rides his bike everywhere. He used to raise chickens, but now he's giving the cheese board a run for their money by baking bread. So I'd like to introduce historian, teacher, bread baker, bicyclist, David Beal.
Well, thanks a lot, Peretz, and thank you, Stephanie, for setting up this talk. Really appreciate it, and thank you to all of you for coming. Here is the two-dimensional version of our book. The three-dimensional version is in back, in case you're wondering, it weighs in at 5 pounds, 4 ounces. It comes with a lifetime orthopedic insurance. Peretz pointed out that the subtitle of the book is A New History. This is a little bit tongue-in-cheek because there isn't actually an old history. This is, I think, a better title would be The First History of Hasidism. And I'll explain a little bit about how it's new in terms of approach in just a moment. You see there on the bottom, there are 8 names of scholars, 2 from the U.S., 1 from Poland, and 5 from Israel. So this is a collectively produced book, a collectively authored book, and I feel very privileged to have been a part of it. So let me say something about the history of Hasidism. The book is, in a sense, written against some of the prevailing views of Hasidism. Simon Dubnow was, in fact, the first historian of Hasidism, who published his History of Hasidism in 1931, sort of set the ground rules that other scholars have more or less followed. Dubnow argued that Hasidism was a response to crisis in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. The Ukrainian uprising of Khmelnytsky in 1648, he said, destroyed the Jewish communities. Hasidism was a response to this, this destruction. It was a revolt against the rabbis. It was a revolt of the unlettered, of the poor, against the communal establishment. Other scholars, like Gershom Scholem, argued that it was a response to a different kind of crisis, the Sabbatean messianic movement of the 17th century. Hasidism, he says, was a response to this. Others had their own forms of crisis to which they thought Hasidism was a response. In addition, all of the great scholars from earlier in the 20th century basically stopped at the year 1815. 1815 is when the last of the founding generations of Hasidic leaders died. And they basically said, look, Hasidism as a fruitful, original, creative movement was an 18th century phenomenon. Dubnov said that after 1815, it went into decline, and after 1867, into absolute decline. If you look at even a writer like Martin Buber, who, of course, popularized Hasidism in a very important way to this day, really, Buber also says that the creative period of Hasidism is the 18th century, and the Hasidim that he knew when he grew up in his grandfather's house in Galicia, in Poland, that those Hasidim really, he thought, were degenerate. So they saw the creative period as the 18th century, which is one of the reasons why the only histories of Hasidism that we have basically end at 1815. In order to write the whole thing, we had to basically come up with a different approach. And our approach is, first of all, that Hasidism was not a response to crisis. Hasidism, by the time Hasidism emerges as a movement, and that's actually an interesting question, when does it actually become a movement? The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth is actually stabilized. It is enjoying growth, economic prosperity, and the crisis that will afflict the Commonwealth, which is going to start in 1772 when it's carved up by its neighbors, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, that crisis still lies a little bit in the future. So Hasidism actually emerges at a time of relative stability. Moreover, Hasidism is not primarily, at least initially, a movement of the poor and the uneducated. This is the tax roll from the town of Mijibuj or Mizbish. This was the town to which the Baal Shem Tov, who is Hasidim consider the founder of Hasidism, to which he came probably at around the year 1740. He died in 1760. And what's fascinating here is that house number 93, we learn, is occupied by Dr. Baal Shem, Kabbalist. Dr. Baal Shem, Kabbalist. Now, what was a Baal Shem? Baal Shem was a magician or a miracle worker. What a Baal Shem did is he knew how to manipulate the divine names for magical purposes. He wrote amulets. In the days before antibiotics, you had to get an amulet if you got sick. I don't know how effective it was, but he knew how to write these amulets. And so he was employed by his community as a communal official. He lived tax-free in a communal house. What this tells you is the Baal Shem Tov is not some itinerant, you know, nature-loving guy, you know, wandering around the Carpathian mountains. He is a settled member of the establishment. Now, he is, you know, perhaps not a Talmud scholar, but he certainly is not an uneducated man either. And so Hasidism actually starts, well, it's not clear that it really starts with the Baal Shem Tov because there's no evidence that he set out to found a movement. And in fact, this is a kind of interesting way in which Hasidism resembles early Christianity. That is, it has a person that people consider to be the founder or the leader who, as far as we can tell, didn't set out to found anything at all. I mean, Jesus had a kind of some kind of a circle around him. He was not out to found a religion. It was some kind of renewal movement within Second Temple Judaism. The same is true of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov is part of a larger world of Eastern European pietism. These are people like other Baal Shem, that's the plural, who cultivate a kind of piety that involves, for example, penances of various kinds. So if you've committed a sin, you might sit in an icy river in the winter or on an anthill in the summer. So you would afflict your body as a way of atoning for your sins. The Baal Shem Tov does, he's part of this world, but he introduces a new version of pietism. He says that afflicting yourself is not the highest form of pietism. Instead, one should worship God with joy, and you should take your sinful thoughts and elevate them rather than suppressing them. He has a different approach. He is original in that regard. He's not simply a member of this culture that has preceded it. We call it Hasidism with a small H, to distinguish it from Hasidism with a capital H. But Hasidism with a capital H emerges out of the old Hasidism. It's not actually, it differs in certain ideas, but it draws upon some of the same people who are attracted to the Baal Shem Tov. He has a kind of a circle. We wouldn't even call them disciples, really. They're just a circle around him. And one of these figures is named Dov Ber, who is the Magid, or the preacher, of the town of Mezrich. And Dov Ber dies in 1772. He is the first one to actually have a court, that is, to hold court, to have people come to him on pilgrimage, to sit at his table, the kind of thing that becomes really institutionalized in later Hasidism, and there are hundreds of these courts. He seems to have invented. It does not seem to be invented by the Baal Shem Tov himself. But even Dov Ber does not seem to have seen himself as founding a movement. Now, in 1772, the year that he dies in December of 1772, in 1772, Elijah, the Gaon of Vilna, the in many ways greatest Talmudic scholar of his day, he does not hold any communal office, but he is recognized as a great authority, signs on to a ban on Hasidism. Why exactly he does this is still a little bit unclear, but he does. He has a kind of obsession with the Hasidim, an obsession that when he dies in 1797, pretty much dies with him. So he really is the figure of primary opposition to Hasidism. And Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich, attracts a group, he brings a group of his disciples together in Mezrich in July of 1772 to try to figure out what are they going to do about this opposition. This is the first time a group of Hasidic leaders actually comes together, and probably they begin to see themselves now as constituting a movement. That is, it is in reaction to the opponents that the movement begins to conceptualize itself as having an identity. So the opponents say of the Hasidim that they're mitchastim, which means pretending to be pious. They take this term Hasidim or Hasidut now as the name of their fledgling movement. And these disciples of the Magid then scatter, they form their own courts, and it's this third generation that really is the founders, or I guess you could call them second generation, that are the founders of Hasidism as an actual movement. So the movement originates in Podolia and Volhynia, which is right here. It's in the southeastern part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And there are just a few centers here in the 18th century. So it's still a very small and scattered movement in its origins. And probably by the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, we're still talking about maybe in the thousands, in the low thousands, if that, of Hasidim. So in other words, the claim that Hasidism has its creative period in the 18th century is not true demographically. The movement, in fact, is going to have its heyday in the 19th century. Now, and indeed, this is one of our major arguments, that the golden age of Hasidism is in the 19th century. It is in the 19th century that Hasidism develops a lot of its really characteristic features. It develops into a mass movement. How many Hasidim were there in Eastern Europe? Well, that's very hard to say. We had a lot of debates about how you actually get good demographic data, and you can't. But it's likely that something like 35-40% of Eastern European Jews, to some degree or the other, identified with Hasidism. Some of them may have been sort of fellow travelers. Some of them may have been full-on Hasidim. It's a little hard to say. By the middle of the 19th century, the real center of Hasidism is in this area, which is Galicia, and in this area, which is central Poland. By now, Poland has been divided up by its neighbors, and the Hasidim live under Russia, which has absorbed this whole area here, as well as Poland, and Austria, which has absorbed this area of Galicia. Other outposts are now to be found further to the south in Hungary, and of course they will become very important later on. Now, I want to say something about how one can recognize a Hasid in the 18th century. Now, you will probably tell me, of course, this boy here must be a Hasid because this is how the Hasidim dress. He's wearing the fur hat or shtreimel. He's wearing a long coat or kapote. And this is done by an artist who went to Poland and drew pictures of the Jews that he found there. But these are almost certainly not Hasidim. This is the way Jews dressed in the 18th century. And I'll come back to this a little bit later on, because this is actually a fairly interesting question of Hasidic dress. We know the Hasidim because we see them on the streets of Brooklyn or Mea Shearim or Bnei Brak in Israel, dressed in their long coats and their fur hats. And we therefore assume, as they themselves assume, that this is how they've always distinguished themselves. But that's not the case. In the 18th century, this is standard Jewish dress. Now, in the 19th century, the Hasidim developed the idea of a court into a very, in some cases, opulent institution. The big movements of Hasidism in the 19th century, Sadigora, Belts, Ger, these very large courts often had opulent synagogues, opulent palaces for their leaders. Some people call these courts regal courts because, in fact, the rebbes, the leaders, styled themselves as nobility, and they built very opulent palaces for themselves. Not all of them. Some of them were quite poor. But the wealthier of them, the whole ritual of the court, all of the it had enormous number of attendants and onhangers, and rituals that pertain to performing a pilgrimage to the court. These are fascinating phenomena that begin in the 18th century but are really institutionalized in the 19th. And we devote a great deal of time to discussing what was the Hasidic court actually like? What was it like to visit there? What was it like to go on pilgrimage there?
You're listening to Jewish historian David Beal, whose new book is Hasidism, A New History, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
We also discuss, and this is something that has not been dealt with much in the literature, I think it's a very important chapter written by Marcin Wojcinski, our Polish colleague, who actually works in local archives. He finds the Hasidim in small towns in Poland, and he describes what it was like to live as a Hasid when you weren't going to the court. So the Hasidim had these small prayer houses called Shtiblach, and he describes what actually went on in these prayer houses. And he discovered very interestingly that most of these Hasidim in various localities were not necessarily the poor. Many of them were merchants, and Hasidism for them was a little bit like the Rotary Club. That is, it allowed you to develop networks of other merchants in other towns because you were all Hasidim of the Rebbe of Belts or the Rebbe of Sadagora or something of this sort. Another thing that happens in the 19th century is the development of a real strong dynastic principle in Hasidism. That is, in the 18th century, it wasn't at all clear whether a Rebbe, a tzaddik, as it's called in Hebrew, would have any followers after his death. Who would take up his mantle? In many cases, nobody. In the 19th century, starting the early 19th century, the dynastic principle becomes more and more important, and it develops in different ways. We discuss these. It's very interesting. In some cases, it's the firstborn son. In some cases, all of the sons go off and establish their court. So you get a kind of fragmentation. In some cases, it's the favored student rather than a son. And then there's the role of the widow of the Rebbe. The widow of the Rebbe could often play a very powerful role in determining who succeeds. And so there's a role for women in this as well. That's an interesting subject that I'll be happy to talk about later on. I want to come back to the question of dress now. Another French artist who traveled through Poland in the Poland and Russia in the mid-19th century, 1846. Now, 1846 is a very interesting year because this is a year that the Russian government promulgated something called the Dress Decree, which said that Jews had to give up their traditional dress and adopt some form of modern dress, either Russian or could be Polish. This was not necessarily enforced that vigorously or universally, but nevertheless, it was a challenge to the Jews that they had to change their, you know, give up their traditional ways of their traditional costumes. Now, these costumes are almost certainly the same as any other Jews. Okay? Just as it was in the 18th century, these are typical Jewish costumes. In this case, the hat is not the shtreimel, and it's a different form. It's the called the shpodek. So it's a different form of the hat that Hasidim later will wear as well. But I also want to say something interesting about the woman here. So notice the title, the Hasid and his wife, not the Hasid and the Hasida, right? So one of the big questions that we debated in our group was, were women Hasidim? And if so, when? Now, in the 18th century, there's no question that women are not Hasidim. The Hasidim are men. They style themselves according to something called the Chevre, or what's called in English, the technical term is a confraternity, just like the Chevre Kedisha is a group of men who perform burials. There are other Chevres like this in the traditional community for different purposes. And the Hasidim form themselves as a Chevre. Now, women are never members of Chevres. And so therefore, women are not Hasidim in the 18th century. In the 19th century, still a question. Women do go to the courts. A woman is infertile. She'll go to the Rebbe to get a blessing. But that doesn't mean she's a Hasid. After all, Christians go to courts as well. And so it would appear that in the 19th century, women are probably not Hasidim either. I'll come back to this question for the 20th century in just a moment, but a story about this. We had a debate in our group about the 20th century. And one of my colleagues said, women are Hasidim in contemporary times. Another colleague, these are both people who really know the contemporary scene. Another one said, no, they're not. They're never counted as Hasidim. They're maybe wives of Hasidim, but they're not Hasidim. So the first colleague, Sam Heilman, who has tremendous connections in various Hasidic courts, he says, I'll settle this right now. So the Hasidim are not supposed to be on the internet, but they are. And so he's got the email of the Gabbai, the assistant to the Rebbe of Munkach. He sends him an email. He says, are women Hasidim? 30 seconds later, the answer comes back. Yes, they are. So we decided that settled it, although our colleague who says they were was not persuaded. But I'll come back to that in just a second. So if this dress is not necessarily Hasidic in the mid-19th century, something is changing, and the dress decree does make a difference. The Hasidim are among the leaders of opposition to the dress decree. Especially in Poland, the Rebbe of Wurka was a particularly powerful voice against the dress decree. And so the Hasidim now have a motivation to keep their traditional dress. And it becomes now more and more distinctively Hasidic, not because it is Hasidic originally, but because it is traditional Jewish dress. And as they become more and more the opponents of the modern world, as indeed they do in the 19th century, they keep that dress as an emblem of their opposition. So here we have at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century probably, and here their dress does distinguish them probably for the first time as Hasidim. So I don't want to put a specific date on this, late 19th, early 20th century. But by the late 19th century, Hasidism has fallen on hard times. In general, the Jews of Eastern Europe are becoming impoverished. This affects the Hasidic courts that can no longer collect taxes from their members. And they're falling on hard times. So by World War I, Hasidism is beginning to feel a real economic crunch. And World War I has a devastating impact on Hasidism, because a lot of the battles are fought in their heartland, in Galicia in particular, and also in Poland. So a lot of the Rebbes flee to the cities, Warsaw and even more Vienna. And Hasidism now for the first time becomes an urban phenomenon instead of a phenomenon of small towns or shtetlach. And in the interwar period, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution has a devastating impact on the Hasidism in Russia. They have to either go underground or flee. Poland is where it flourishes between the wars. And perhaps the biggest of the groups in Poland between the wars was Ger or Gur. Now, I don't have time to discuss the impact of Hasidism on the Holocaust. It's a fascinating chapter. I actually wrote that chapter in the book. But of course, the Holocaust basically destroys the Hasidic movement. Some of the Rebbes escape. Some of the most important ones escape. The Rebbe of Ger escapes to Palestine. Chabad, or Lubavitch Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, escapes from Poland via Latvia to the United States. A number of the others escape. The Rebbe of Belz escapes from Poland to Hungary and from there to Palestine. So a number of the important leaders do survive, but most of the Hasidim are murdered. It's, I think, a remarkable story. I mean, one of the things I discovered, I'll just give you the one sort of takeaway here from this chapter, is that we normally think of the Hasidim, you know, that they could, there's no way that they could resist the Nazis. These people are, they're not modern. They're, you know, they probably very passive. It's all untrue. They were able to mobilize. They had networks. They could mobilize their networks, usually to save the Rebbe, sometimes to save each other, forging papers, building bunkers. It's really, you know, smuggling across borders. This is a remarkable story that I think hasn't been fully told. So the third part of our book is about the post-war, post-World War II Hasidism. And this is a story we call Death and Resurrection. Because Hasidism really emerges like a phoenix out of the ashes, and out of maybe a few thousand survivors has built itself up so that today, in our estimate, there's something like 700,000 or 750,000 Hasidim in the world. This is a remarkable story. How did they do it? And that's what we deal with in that section of the book. It's a story of remarkable persistence. Of course, most people are familiar with Chabad, and they missionized to secular Jews. But even a bigger part of the story, Chabad is actually a fairly small movement relative to other Hasidic groups. Satmar is much bigger. How did Satmar do it? Well, the Satmar Rebbe was a kind of a genius at attracting in traditional Jews from Eastern Europe who were not Hasidim to join his particular court. So this is a fascinating part of the story. This just gives you a sense of where they are. They're, of course, in Brooklyn, but also upstate New York, Kiryas Yoel, and these other Hasidic townships, where they've actually, in an interesting kind of way, replicated the shtetl in upstate New York. One of the fascinating things about Hasidism in the post-war period is that before the war, if somebody wanted to found a court, for example, Yoel Teitelbaum came from the town of Siget, where his older brother was the Rebbe. So what does he do? He'd like to be a Rebbe also. So he decamps for the town of Satmar, and he sets up court there, and he becomes the Satmar Rebbe. Now, before World War II, that phenomenon existed in the United States. There's the Boston Rebbe, the Cleveland Rebbe. You know, you had a number of these figures who took the place names where they lived as their name. After the Holocaust, impossible. After the Holocaust, you have to conserve the names from Eastern Europe because they are now holy sites. And so today, Satmar is divided between two Satmar Rebbes who are competing with each other. You cannot invent a new name. So it's a kind of a conservation of the brand, you might say. And this is an interesting phenomenon. The other interesting phenomenon, I think, is that Hasidism, which was an Eastern European phenomenon, one in which you would travel to the court of the Rebbe, but you wouldn't necessarily travel that far. I mean, it might be because transportation was not that good, it might take you some time to get there. But what's happened after the war, it's become a global phenomenon. And you have courts that have followers in different places. The Rebbe of Belz has followers. The seat of the Rebbe, the court, is in Jerusalem. But he's got followers in Stamford Hill, London. He's got followers in New York. And so how do they go to him? On airplanes. You've all been on airplanes to Israel. They're on those planes. And this is not always the easiest part of the story, because sometimes they're on the planes and they cause a lot of trouble. But they are, it has become a global phenomenon in which they use modern technology in order to further their court. In Israel, Of course, this just gives you a sense. I mean, this is not surprising. Jerusalem, B'nai Brak are the two largest centers, but they are also in other places as well. Now, Toldot Aharon is a small, very conservative group in Jerusalem, originally from Hungary. It's different in the sense that it's named actually for its founder rather than for a place. This is Arla Roth was his name. They're very strict and conservative. The women are supposed to wear no makeup at all. They're supposed to shave their heads and wear a black scarf after they marry. And they are one of three groups in Israel that follow some very, very strict rules in terms of sexual relations. The most extreme is the Ger Hasidim, in which husbands and wives are supposed to have sex only once a month, right after the woman's menstrual period, after she's purified. Women and men are not supposed to look at each other. A husband is not to address his wife by her name. She is to walk behind him. These are all entirely new regulations. And the Toldot Aharon also has regulations like this. Why suddenly has sexuality become such a fraught thing for these particular groups? First of all, there are precedents earlier in Hasidism, not for the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov apparently did not have that kind of attitude, but there are earlier precedents. But it would seem as if this is a post-war phenomenon. It's one of the ways that these groups fight the modern world by saying we do something utterly opposite of what people do in the modern secular world, and it's to distinguish themselves from other Hasidic groups, what Freud called the narcissism of small differences. So they distinguish themselves by having these practices that that separate them from other ultra-Orthodox Jews. So also in connection with Hasidic dress, this will perhaps surprise you, although those who went to the De Young Museum a couple of years ago will recognize this. The fashion artist Jean-Paul Gaultier dressed up his models in Hasidic dress. And I don't have a picture of this, so you'll just have to imagine it. But he took these models and he had them walk around the streets of Brooklyn. And he photographed the response of real Hasidim to these models. Now, this is shocking because, first of all, in Judaism, a man must not dress as a woman or a woman as a man. Okay, so clearly that's a violation of this. But it's even a deeper violation in the sense that for the Hasidim today, the way they dress is now an intrinsic part of their identity. And so to have a non-Jewish artist dress up, I don't know if these models are Jewish or not, it doesn't matter, have them dress up as Hasidim violates the segregation, the distinctiveness that the Hasidim want to cultivate for their own identities. But in a sense, what this illustrates to us is the fact that the Hasidim, despite the fact that they would like to segregate themselves from the modern world, are totally a part of it. And they cannot escape it. And indeed, an overarching argument for our book, and with this I'll conclude, is that Hasidism, far from being just anti-modern or some kind of throwback to the 18th century, some kind of medieval fossil living among us, is in fact an integral part of modern Jewish history and the modern world. Thank you.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Jewish historian David Beal, whose new book is Hasidism, A New History. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Could you explain the role of the court? It seems to function, have religious, legal, and administrative functions all combined. Is there more than that that it does? Or is the whole community centered on the court? And is the court the rabbi?
So the court is where the rabbi sits. He, it's his home, but it is also the place of pilgrimage. And there's a certain experience one has in making pilgrimage there, of praying in his, you know, in his synagogue, of bringing a, you want to bring a question to him. You write it on a piece of paper called a kvittel. You pay a certain amount, what's called a pidyon, to him in exchange for his blessing. These are all highly ritualized practices by the 19th century. And what's fascinating here is that this system of the court and the pilgrimage, remember, the Hasidic community is not just located next to the court. It can be scattered quite a distance from there. It may be, you know, several days' walk from the court, maybe even more. And so what the court means is the development of a Jewish geography, which is totally different from the geographies the Jews had since time immemorial. That is, if you were a Jew living in medieval France or Spain or Germany or even Poland before Hasidism, or even in the time of Hasidism, if you weren't a Hasid, you would live in a community. There'd be a town rabbi whose function was legal, who would give you, you have a chicken, you want to know if the chicken is kosher, you bring him to the Rav, and he would tell you whether it is or isn't. That was his role. You might go to a synagogue, and there'd be a preacher there, usually a different person than the Rebbe, or than the rabbi, excuse me. And you would live your life in that circumscribed community. What Hasidism does is it breaks open the community. It creates a transcommunal community. And that is something totally new in Jewish history. And today, of course, it's global. But this is something really new, which means your religious experience is completely new. You have to figure out how to have a religious experience in your town with other members of that that Hasidic group in the shtiebel. And then several times a year, you would make pilgrimage to the court and have that experience. So it's an entirely different spiritual experience than what Jews had before.
I'm trying to figure out what language all these Hasidic courts spoke and their followers spoke.
Yeah. The sermons were all in Yiddish. And Hebrew was not a spoken language. So what would happen is the sermon would be transcribed by a disciple and then translated to Hebrew and published in Hebrew. It turns out this process is a very complicated one, and I have a former student who's now teaching at Stanford who's working on this, oftentimes there's more than one transcription that was done, and so you get differences between the versions of the sermon. But this is a bilingual culture in which Yiddish is the vernacular, and so, of course, you would give the sermon in Yiddish because you want your followers to be able to understand. What's interesting today is that Yiddish has become a holy language for not just the Hasidim, but for ultra-Orthodox Jews in general. Yiddish is a holy language because it was almost destroyed in the war. And so Yiddish is still a language that's used for sermons. But Hasidim are, like many other Jews, are multilingual. So, for example, in Israel, even if the Hasidim speak Yiddish to each other, almost all of them know Hebrew. They could understand a sermon in Hebrew. I know that in Chabad yeshivas, where you may have children who come from English-speaking homes, you know, because their parents may have been Balei Tshuva or whatever. What they do in the yeshiva, they study the text, say the Talmud in the Hebrew or Aramaic. They translate it to Yiddish, and then they translate it to English. So that's, you have to have the Yiddish in there because it's now a holy language.
Do all the Hasidic groups have an anti-scientific, an anti-economic focus? I mean, obviously, in the diamond cutters in New York don't have an anti-economic focus, but in Israel, and is that the to have the education focused so heavily on religion that it's never focused on more practical things?
Yeah. So education is, for boys in particular, purely religious. So they don't learn, like in this country, they would not learn English. They would not learn to read in English. If they're going to read in English, they have to learn it outside the yeshiva. They will not learn mathematics. They basically will not study any secular subjects. And, you know, what you need to know for working in certain enterprises, you sort of have to pick up on your own. It's a little bit looser for women. Women are allowed to study some secular subjects, and that's both true here and in Israel. So actually, women have greater economic prospects usually than men in a modern economy. But, I mean, this is one of the very big problems, especially for those who choose to leave this world. There's, by the way, a movie that I was actually a consultant on called One of Us, which is about people who have chosen to leave the Hasidic world and the difficulties that they have. And one of the difficulties is that they have absolutely no skills. I mean, they may have certain commercial skills, but they don't have skills for a modern economy. It's a big problem.
Thank you for your talk. I'm curious regarding the interplay currently of Chabad, which is part of the Hasidic movement and very inclusive, versus all of the majority of the other groups where they pride themselves on separatists and are actually not very inclusive to secular Jews at all.
Right, right. So there's one other group that you have to include with Chabad, and that's Bratslav, which has a sort of a history of its own. But they actually are, in the last few decades, have also become a kind of quasi-missionizing group, or they attract people in who are kind of spiritual seekers. Chabad is actually, going back to its origins in the late 18th century, is a distinctive group. It's really quite different from the other Hasidic groups of that time, and it was true that it was different in the 19th and 20th century as well. The missionizing, all of Hasidism was missionizing at one point, because how else did they attract people in? They had to recruit. But that recruitment probably ends sometime towards the end of the 19th century. And in the 20th century, there's not a great deal of recruitment in. And that's true of Chabad also. Now, Chabad had a particular challenge because its heartland was Belarus, or White Russia. And when the Russian Revolution happened, they cracked down very hard on religion. So Chabad members either went underground or they abandoned Chabad. I mean, we know actually of people who served in the Bolshevik secret police who were former Chabad students, and they had to rebuild by recruitment, and they did recruiting actually in Poland between the wars, and then when they come to the United States, they have to recruit also. The idea of recruiting among secular Jews, this whole phenomenon of the worldwide mission where they send out, you know, couples. By the way, that's an area where women play a very, very important role, as I would say, virtual equals to their husbands in this missionizing. This was an invention of the seventh and last Rebbe of Lubavitch or Chabad, Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And, you know, they're to be found everywhere. I mean, in my little shtetl of Davis, California, the it turns out there are now two Chabad houses. I thought one was enough. But, yeah, there's a second one that's open that is aimed primarily at the students. And I guess the other, the older one, you know, is more people in the community. And I have to say, they're extraordinarily effective at what they do. I just had a meeting with some students the other day, and they said, we all go to Chabad. And I said, well, that's interesting. I mean, why don't you go to Hillel? They said, no, Hillel's become political. You know, we want to go to a place where they're not talking politics. It's very interesting. And they're very effective. And they send outstanding people, I have to say, to, I mean, some of their best people are absolutely outstanding. The other movements, the way they recruit, I mean, after the war, as I said, Teitelbaum, for example, recruited among Orthodox Jewish survivors who hadn't necessarily been Hasidim. But they were looking for some, you know, anchor in the New World, and they were looking for community, and so he provided that. One of the ways they recruited was by their schools. In other words, they would establish yeshivas, and people who are not necessarily members of a particular court, like Satmar or Bobov, which is another big New York group, they would send their children to the yeshivas, and then through the children, the parents would become followers. So they work in a somewhat different way. And this business of recruiting secular people in Chabad, there is a pecking order. That is, if you are a Baal Tshuva, you know, become religious, and you join Chabad, then and you want to marry, you must marry another Baal Tshuva. You can't marry somebody who's been in, you know, whose family's been in the movement. And it's very typical that your children will also marry the children of Baalei Tshuva. Maybe in the generation after that won't be the case. But that's an interesting way in which they divide, even though in theory everybody who becomes religious should be the same. Not really.
So if we are recognizing the Baal Shem Tov as the inspiration for the movement, and one of his fundamental teachings is to serve life or God with joy, rather than prescribed rules as the fundamental life point. The number you gave is this approximate of 750,000 Hasidim today. This, for me, is this major discrepancy that touches me time and time again. What percentage of people who identify as Hasidim today are practicing and living that as their fundamental root, which we are recognizing as the fundamental root of the movement itself?
Yeah. So to give you a full answer to this, I didn't really develop this, but this idea of worshiping God with joy is expressed in practice through song and dance. And they all do this. They all do this. It is very joyful in the way in which they express their religiosity. Now there are variations. That is, one of the problems with speaking of you know, what is the Hasidic position is that there's actually a range, and there are some Hasidic groups that tend more towards the ascetic than others. You know, and I wouldn't say, for example, the fact that a group like Ger or Toldot Aharon have these very strict sexual regulations means that they aren't joyful in the way they worship God. but it's pretty clear that in those cases, that joy is not to be found in the family, in those groups. That's not necessarily true for other Hasidic groups. These are exceptions, and they're fairly extreme exceptions, even though Ger is very big. In the 18th century, Hasidism, a lot of the Hasidic thinkers were working out concepts in Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah. One of the interesting things, and they developed these ideas of joy and ecstatic worship of God, or what's called dvekut, unifying yourself with God. They expressed this in Kabbalistic terms. But by the 19th century, most Hasidic groups are no longer particularly Kabbalistic. there are some exceptions. Chabad is one of them. But certainly by the 20th century, if you go to a Hasidic, you know, tish, the table of the Rebbe, and you listen to his sermon, it's likely it won't have anything, any concepts taken from Jewish mysticism. So the movement has become, you know, it has certain practices. I would call them bodily practices, like singing and dancing, very important, that it does have in common. And it has institutions that it has in common, like the Rebbe, his court, his table or tish. These are all part of what is common to Hasidism, but then each one will differ in terms of its ethos or its character. Okay, thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Jewish historian David Beal, whose new book is Hasidism, A New History. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.